Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. And today we're going to talk about expanding Medicaid here in New Mexico. Last week, Governor Susana Martinez announced that the state of New Mexico would expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. The U.S. Supreme Court had ruled that states could not be required to expand at risk of losing current Medicaid funding. And then it was up to governors around the nation to choose whether to expand the program in their states. There was a question for a while about whether Governor Susana Martinez would expand or not. It was kind of this to expand or not to expand discussion that was going on here in New Mexico and in other states. Governor Susana Martinez is also one of just a few Republican governors who has planned to expand Medicaid. And today we're going to take your calls on what this means for the state of New Mexico and also your questions about how the program will be implemented and what it means for providers and for the folks who become eligible for coverage under this expansion. And joining us to discuss this morning, we have Secretary Sydney Squire. She is with the New Mexico Department of Human Services. Thank you for coming down from Santa Fe today. Julie Weinberg, she is Medicaid Director for the state of New Mexico. And Lauren Reichel, she is the Director of the Rio Riba County Department of Human Services. Good morning to you all.
Thank you. Good morning.
So I wanted to start, and perhaps Secretary Squire, this is a good place to start with you. Can you explain exactly who are the approximately 170,000 people who will become eligible for Medicaid under this expansion? Kind of what are the characteristics of this segment of the population?
Well, unlike Medicaid as a whole, which generally covers children, the population that will be coming onto the rolls are mainly adults. They are low-income adults, below 138% of the poverty level. That is about $15,600 a year. So these are low-income individuals, adults, that need care, and the governor's decided that they should get it.
How is there any insight you can give us to the process of that decision-making as far as kind of how different aspects of the decision were weighed and how they ended up kind of playing out on that scale and the final decision being yes to expand?
Absolutely. New Mexico is somewhat unique than other states. Most states are really wrestling with this because even though the federal government is going to pay, they say 100%, there still is a cost to the states. So most states are really struggling. But New Mexico is fairly unique. And what the governor took into account were two things. We have two things going on. One of them is a state insurance program that is paid for by general funds. We call it the state coverage insurance.
That's which covers adults, right?
It does. It does. So that is currently general fund funded. Well, under expansion, the federal government will take over that. So there's a big savings there. But I think even more importantly, where the money is really going to come from is there is a premium tax on MCOs, and they pay that tax.
What's an MCO?
Oh, I'm sorry. Managed Care Organization.
That's what I'm here for.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
I hate that insider stuff, but I'm
That's
sorry.
That's okay. I may pause each and every one of you during the hour to just help us with some of the acronyms and things, but don't
no
worry.
Problem.
Just move. Go ahead forward, and I'll catch the things that...
No problem. Thank you for that.
Sure thing.
So there is a premium tax on the managed care organizations, and they are the ones that are going to be providing insurance and care for the new people coming on. So there is a tax on them for everybody that's on there now and everybody that's new. So when you add 170,000 new folks to the rolls, that's a big tax increase. And some of that money comes back to the state government. And frankly, I think her decision was based largely on those two things, that it turns out that as expensive as expansion truly is, we can make more revenue in the state to cover that. So the state essentially can come out better than if they didn't expand. And I think that was the key that made her decision.
Well, and that was part of the some of the opposition to expansion was it's going to cost us, it's going to be expensive just because the federal government provides 100% of the expansion costs for a couple of years. And then the 10% is phased in for the state. So by 2020, the state is going to be paying 10% of the cost of the expansion part, right?
That's absolutely correct. But that brings up a very good point, I think one that we should touch on right away, and that is the promise of the federal government to fund this 100% or in perpetuity 90%. There are people, and I think the governor is one of them, that's fairly skeptical about whether or not the federal government can keep this promise. As we know, there's a big budget battle going on in Washington, D.C. The country is $16 trillion in debt, and so these promises make governors like Governor Martinez a little bit nervous that they won't be able to keep that promise. And if they don't keep that promise, she won't be able to keep the promise of expansion to the folks in New Mexico.
Well, and in her statement when she announced the expansion, she did make very clear that that folks who are added to the Medicaid rolls under the expansion, if the funding were to cease or be significantly cut from the federal side, that it's kind of last in, first out scenario where the last people to be brought into the system under the expansion eligibility will be the first to be bumped out of the system if the funding doesn't come through as expected.
That's correct. The governor is very committed to children, and she doesn't want to see any kind of across-the-board cuts that might adversely affect children. So if the federal government does not keep its promise, the adults will, that have just come on will be the first to go, and she's promised to protect the children.
Got it. Got it. Julie Weinberg, State Medicaid Director. Things to add? Are there things to add to what the Secretary has said from your perspective as Medicaid Director to help us understand kind of what this project is going to mean for the state?
Well,
your eyes are very large.
Yes, I feel like sometimes a deer in the headlight when it comes to this expansion. But no, you know, the governor, I think the secretary basically was very clear on the basis of the governor's decision. And really what we're looking at in the Medical Assistance Division, which is part of HSD, is running as fast as we can to be ready to take care of the up to 170,000 people who'll be enrolling in the Medicaid program.
When does that enrollment start?
They can it coincides with another part of the ACA, which is the Health Insurance Exchange, which open enrollment for that begins in October of 2013. So by default, because the Health Insurance Exchange will make an initial kind of high-level assessment whether a person might be eligible for Medicaid, it kind of starts then, although actual enrollment and eligibility for the program does not start until January 1st, 2014.
So the sorting will start taking place in October with the State Health Exchange, and then the official eligibility will kind of go into effect at the beginning of 2014.
Right. That's when the eligibility can actually begin. So, but people will start to find out and start to realize perhaps that they may be eligible for expansion for under the expansion eligibility.
Julie Weinberg is the State Medicaid Director. Secretary Sydney Squire is also here with us this morning. She's with the New Mexico Human Services Department. And in a few minutes, we'll hear from Lauren Reichel. She is with the Rio Arriba County Human Services Department. We are taking your calls this morning. What do you want to know about how the Medicaid expansion is going to affect New Mexico? The number to call locally here in Albuquerque is 277-588. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. You can post your comments online at KUNM.org, and you can also email us, callinshow@KUNM.org. So I want to come back to you, Julie. Mm-hmm. What are you working on right now with this? Talk to me a little bit about your workflow as this year progresses. What are the kinds of things that you're doing in order to get this expansion up and running?
Well, the department overall is doing a lot of different things. In the Medical Assistance Division, we're starting to work on our, starting to think about our plan, the benefit plan for the expansion eligibles. We're working on getting our Medicaid eligibility determination updated to meet the law. We're working on what they call a verification plan. What are we going to use to verify eligibility? What kinds of information are we going to use to verify income? And trying to keep up with all the sub-regulatory guidance that we're getting and some new regulations, proposed regulations that have been issued. So we're pedaling as fast as we can, trying to keep up with it all. But those are what we really need to do is get our eligibility system ready, And our benchmark plan, what's called a benchmark plan or alternative benefit plan for the new eligibles.
So when you say new eligibles, that we are talking still about this kind of 170,000 potentially people who may enroll.
That's correct.
Are the benefits that those folks become eligible for the same, a little different? How do they compare to the benefits that folks are already in Medicaid? And perhaps, Secretary, you can go with this.
Well, I'm going to let Julie talk about this a bit, but here's the thing about that, is that these are very different populations. The 170 that are coming on are adults. They have different needs than the children. So my guess would be that the benefit packages aren't the same because they don't need the same kind of services.
But this is part of what you're figuring out.
Yes,
it's like, how
exactly.
do we...
Okay. Exactly. Yeah, we're trying, you know, Medicaid is traditionally a program for pregnant women, children, the disabled, and the elderly. And what we're in approximately 170,000 new, potentially new enrollees in the program, these are adults, single or married adults, but they have, as Secretary Squire said, a very different set of needs. We're going to have the young invincibles, I call them, who may only need an annual checkup and a bone set when they fall off their skateboard, right? And then we have the older adults who may have very significant health care needs. And then we have persons, a lot of mental health and substance abuse needs as well coming in. So we really are trying to think very carefully about the benefit package that will best serve this population and is appropriate for the population.
What are some of the are you having any kind of like, shall we say, heated discussions already? Like, where are the areas of contested coverage so far as you're working on that? Like, where are the areas that are like, well, we're not sure if we're going to include this or that? Or
we haven't, you know, we don't have anything hotly contested. We've been discussing starting and looking at our state coverage insurance benefit package, which serves the same population as a starting point.
Can you just take that one and run with it?
We can, under the law, there's a number of different kinds of benchmark plans that the plan you can base your plan on. And one of them, there is the state option we can propose to the Department of Health and Human Services and see what the secretary approves. So we think it's a good starting point simply because we understand the program. We understand how it's utilized. We have experience with the pent-up demand that comes in the very beginning because that's what we had with this program. It needs to be filled out according to the law. And certainly one of the things we talk about a lot is the mental health needs and substance abuse treatment needs of a large portion of the population that will come in initially.
We have a caller on the line, and this is Marianne. Let's go to Marianne in Santa Fe. You're on the air, Marianne. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I very recently, from the beginning of November, was in the hospital for 5 weeks. I had two major surgeries. I am on Medicare, not Medicaid. And then I was in a nursing home after that for 3 weeks. And now I'm down in Santa Fe because I have breast cancer and I have to have another surgery. So there's a lot that Medicare does not cover, and I haven't had the time or the energy. I've been, you know, basically trying to get over the surgeries. My question is, I haven't had a chance to contact Human Resources. Would it be is it okay? Because, I mean, is there a deadline that I'm going to come up against? Because I haven't had a chance to go in to apply for anything, you know. And I'm not making $15,000 a year. I'm not making anywhere near there. I'm not making anything right now, and so I'm very concerned. I do get Social Security, but it's not barely covering anything. And I was just wondering if I am one of those people who would be able to apply and if there is a deadline, if I've missed any kind of a deadline.
So, Julie, where can people find information about eligibility and perhaps even assistance, kind of figuring out how to assess whether those eligibility requirements apply to them?
This is a good question. So the expansion applies to adults up to the age of 65, because from 65 on, there's Medicare. Now, as the caller has said, sometimes Medicare does not cover all of her person's medical expenses. Low-income persons are sometimes also who are on Medicare are sometimes also qualified for Medicaid. We call that being dually eligible. And there is no deadline for – there won't be a deadline for enrolling in the expansion, which hasn't even started yet. But there is no deadline to apply for Medicaid as to be a duly eligible Medicare enrollee. And I urge you to call the local Income Support Division office. And I'm sorry to say I didn't bring those phone numbers with me, but I can get online and get those.
We will get those numbers from you before we let you leave the building.
Okay.
And then we will post them online at KUNM.org. So for all of you listening, we'll get the phone numbers and post them online after the show.
Yes.
This question of dual eligibility, are there any folks who are already covered under Medicaid now who will experience an increased amount of coverage with the expansion?
Let's see. Yes, there can be, because we have persons who are, for instance, only eligible for pregnancy-related services, and they may qualify for the full benefit package under the expansion. We have persons enrolled who are only eligible for family planning services, very important, but that's a very narrow benefit package. And up to 138% of the federal poverty level, they would then be eligible for the full expansion.
And that's this idea that this expansion is for low-income adults, this population that is very selectively served based on conditions, health needs, as you've just described, family planning, pregnancy, that those kind of slices of low-income adult populations are already eligible, but that a broader range of coverage is what now becomes possible for people who are eligible.
Right. They'll be able to, you know, under the alternative benefit plan, as that's being called, the benchmark plan is another common term, they'll be able to see a doctor, and that would be covered by Medicaid now for a particular illness. Right now, under family planning, the person can see a doctor once a year for an annual reproductive health checkup, basically. And so, yes, it does expand the kinds of services they will have access to.
Questions about the expansion of Medicaid here in New Mexico. Governor Susana Martinez announced last week that the state would expand the program under the Affordable Care Act. We'd like to hear from you today. The number to call locally here in Albuquerque is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. You can post your comments online or send an email to callinshow@kunm.org. Human Services Department Secretary Sydney Squire joins us this morning, along with New Mexico Medicaid Director Julie Weinberg. And in a moment, we'll hear from Lauren Reichelt. She is the director of the Human Services Department in Rio Arriba County. I want to go first to an email comment, and this is from Patsy Nelson, who is with the New Mexico Alliance for School-Based Healthcare, and she sent in an email comment. And this is a paraphrased version of what she said, because we have to kind of down a little bit. We do our best to capture the main thoughts, though. She writes, school-based health centers can build a delivery system that will deliver the care effectively. They're located in all areas of the state and provide health services to over 50,000 New Mexico youth. They have positive effects on students' health risk behaviors and outcomes, as well as improving academic performance and health. They can also reduce health care costs. And she writes that the New Mexico Alliance for School-Based Healthcare is strongly encouraging, sustaining, and expanding health centers in schools. So how do school-based health centers figure into Medicaid expansion? Secretary Squire.
Okay, thanks. They are very important, and we have supported them all along. In fact, we have a new program coming out called Centennial Care that does some updating of the Medicaid program, and we had
the existing program.
The existing program, right? And when we were out getting public comment on this, we got an awful lot of comment about access. And access is a huge problem in New Mexico. You know, we have frontier, rural areas, that it's very difficult to get health care to those folks. And the school system is a way to get that health care to kids. And so we certainly do not argue at all with the comments of the email that came in, because we do believe that one of the biggest challenges this state has, whether you expand, whether you don't, whether we revamp the Medicaid current program, is access. Yeah. And that schools can help us with the children, for sure.
Well, I want to go to your comment about revamping Medicaid, because for many, many years, at least my entire career at KUNM, the question of what to do with New Mexico's Medicaid system has been an ongoing question, right? I remember covering the program 4 to 5 years ago and going to a public meeting, and the question was we had expanded the outreach to get more people who are eligible to enroll, and then as the economy stumbled and the state's budget started to hurt, there was this pullback on outreach to get people enrolled. So there is this level of control that the Medicaid system has with respect to either going out and finding people who are eligible and getting them enrolled, or pulling back on that effort to kind of slow enrollment. Explain what that means, Julie, and is that a process that is still used? And can we expect to see that with the expansion? Is there going to be kind of a slow rollout of outreach efforts to get to the 170,000 people who will become eligible under the expansion?
Well, I think it's a understanding that outreach is what gets people into Medicaid, because there always is this we have not found it to be highly effective in increasing the rolls. What is the most highly effective way to increase the rolls and help people stay on the rolls are some of the things that were done during the recession, and that was making it easier for people to recertify their eligibility in Medicaid, so we didn't have these folks drop off and then 3 months later come on. And what we found with that was that it keeps the enrollment steady and high. And, well, when the recession came along, yes, perhaps the outreach effort didn't seem wasn't as robust as it had been in the past, but we didn't need it. We saw the growth in the program just go, you know,
so people were coming in on their own or renewing on their own as opposed to kind of needing to be prodded.
Yes, exactly. And we used, you know, when we did SNAP, which is the food stamp program determinations, we used that to identify children who would also be eligible for Medicaid. And instead of making them come back in and apply for Medicaid.
Well, and that's where you take the application that families have made for food stamps and you take that database. Right. And then you roll those people into the appropriate people into the Medicaid eligibility system. Is that how I know that that's how it works, for example, with APS and free lunches.
Right.
That part of the challenge with that is how do you keep students in the free lunch program? And part of it was linking these databases with the SNAP database, having the information already in it about who is at what income level.
Right. It's sort of like that. We offered to enroll the children and the families. We have to get the person who's applying, the guardian, to say, okay, that's okay. We can't just do it automatically.
It's not automatic.
Right.
Okay.
They have to give us permission. And what's interesting is the kids get on first, even if the adults were eligible too. There's something about adults not wanting, who like a parent who really, you know, is run out of income and truly qualifies for Medicaid under the current rules. They sometimes are reluctant to do that. They, you know, there's a pride involved. There's no, I don't want to do that yet. I'm going to go find a job and things like that. But the kids' growth during the recession was huge. But the adult growth also came. It just came in later.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Nancy in Las Vegas. Good morning, Nancy. You're on the air.
Morning. Thank you very much for the conversation. And I do have a question as a provider. I wanted to know, as we're all glad that people are going to have access to Medicaid and to care, is there going to be any relief for providers in terms of the amount of reimbursement under Medicaid? For instance, currently providers get a little less than $2,000 for 9 months of prenatal care, a delivery, and postpartum, which is a little hard to make it on. Will there be any increase? Thank you.
Secretary Squire.
Well, there is an increase in the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, for primary care physicians, which, of course, in New Mexico, we lack that. We also lack specialists. There's no doubt about it. But the law says that there is an increase, so primary care physicians will be reimbursed a bit more. I don't believe that it speaks to the specialty types or specific genres of doctors. It's really primary care.
So in this case, if you're talking, it sounded like this woman was maybe obstetrics, gynecology, it wouldn't apply to, you're saying it probably wouldn't apply to the question specifics that she asked?
Yeah. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there's a lot of specialties that get covered under the primary care increase, which will bring it up to the current Medicare rates. Sometimes we pay higher than that for those services, but they're not for a global service such as prenatal care and then delivery and postpartum care. And certainly these are questions that we just, for these other providers who might not be affected by this, we just don't have the answers right now as to what's going to happen with that.
Let's go to Lauren Reichelt. She is the director of the Rio Arriba County Human Services Department. Lauren, we first met when I went up to Espanola for one of your health fairs that had to do with some vaccinations. And talk to me about your perspective on this Medicaid expansion and what it means for the providers that you work with in Rio Arriba County.
Well, I see it as being entirely positive. And there are several different kinds of impacts on our health and our economy in Rio Arriba that I think are really important. So I'd like to start with the most obvious, which is how it improves people's health. One of the problems we have in Rio Arriba, and I can't place an exact number on this, is we have a ridiculously high rate of uninsured adults. And that's because approximately 50% of the wages paid through our economy are service and retail wages. And these are jobs that don't have insurance. And so the way that impacts us, it's a double whammy. I work with Rio Arriba County, not with the state, and it's a health and human services department. And one of the services we provide is case management or care coordination for different high-risk populations, including frequent ER users. So to give you one example, there is one patient that we were working with who she was suffering from several chronic illnesses, and she also just couldn't qualify for insurance. And so she kept ending up in the ER in renal failure. And this was 37 visits to the ER, and it cost the hospital $270,000. Being able to get her on insurance will enable me to get her the care she needs, so she's going to be a much happier and healthier person. And at the same time, it's going to save our hospital probably $260,000. So if I'm able to work with 10 of these individuals, then I have saved our system $2.6 million, which could perhaps fund dental care for all the kids in the county or primary care for everyone. So you're spending ridiculously large amounts of money just keeping people from dying when you could spend small amounts of money keeping them healthy and happy. So that's a big, important change, and it's the most obvious. The second huge impact on Rio Arriba is economic. 10 years ago, I looked at our wage economy, and I found that the single largest sector of the economy that it was local government. It was 28% of all wages paid were paid through local government. Several months ago, I looked at it again, and I found that in fact now healthcare is the largest sector of our economy. And it's the private sector, and that's 25% of all wages that are paid in Rio Arriba are health care. And one of the problems that we've been addressing, that our health council has been addressing, most people are aware that Rio Arriba has a very serious substance abuse epidemic we're trying to fight. And I looked at several communities that were demographically similar, but some of them had very high rates of substance abuse and some much lower. And I found that it didn't seem to be related to poverty. The communities that had the high rates of substance abuse actually brought in more income than the other two communities. That was Espanola and Chimayo are wealthier than Taos and Tierra Amarilla. But we had very high rates of adults commuting long distances out of the county to work. whereas in TA and Taos, the commute times were maybe 10, 15 minutes. And what this means is that in a poor community where you can't afford after-school care, you're taking all your healthy adults and you're exporting them out of the community, and there's nobody left, say, to bring homework to school for the kid who forgot it, or take care of the sick neighbor, or just be a role model. And so we're trying to bring those jobs back into Rio Riba. The Medicaid expansion is going to result, I don't know in how many jobs, but it will be a lot of jobs, and some of those will be in our very rural communities where the only actual employer is the health clinic. And so that enables us to change the shape of our economy. Another thing it does is it creates a private sector. So all of those people that you are employing, they're people who go out and vote, but they vote based on they want a government that provides good policy, not a government that hires them. And so if local government is your single largest employer, then you have people who are going to vote for people who are going to give them a job. If your largest employer is healthcare, then you're going to go out and vote for people who are going to promise you good schools because you need good schools to have healthcare, and you want your kids to be schooled near you. You're not in Los Alamos, and you don't want to take your children to Los Alamos. And you're going to vote for county government that will create good health policy, and that's good governance. So you've really changed the whole social structure of the county by doing this.
We're talking about expanding Medicaid here in New Mexico. That was Lauren Reichelt. She is with the Health and Human Services Department in Rio Arriba County. We are taking your calls this morning. Locally, you can call 277-5866 with questions for the Human Services Department Secretary Sydney Squire and also for Medicaid Director Julie Weinberg. We are going to take a quick break, but we'd like to get a few more calls lined up. The toll-free number is 877-899-5866. You can also email callinshow@kunm.org or post your comments online. Again, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Sandia Prep offers rigorous academics and remarkable opportunities for students in grades 6 through 12, now accepting applications for fall 2013. Learn more at sandiaprep.org. This message sponsored by tax-exempt Sandia Prep School.
Join us Saturday night at 7 for a special presentation of Ear to the Ground as we continue our series of recordings from Jazz Under the Stars, featuring performances from the Charlie Christian Project and the Brazil Project. That's the Brazil Project and the Charlie Christian Project in performance on Ear to the Ground, Saturday night at 7 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. It's about 8:37 here on this Thursday morning. And today we're talking about the expansion of Medicaid here in New Mexico. Last week, Governor Susana Martinez announced that New Mexico would expand the Medicaid program to include a potential 170,000 additional low-income adults, in addition to the mainly children, the elderly, and the disabled who are covered under the current Medicaid program here in New Mexico. Lauren Reichelt, director of the Rio Arriba County Department of Health and Human Services, is joining us this morning. Also, Julie Weinberg, Medicaid director for the state of New Mexico, and Secretary Sydney Squire with the New Mexico Department of Human Services. Julie, you wanted to jump in after the comments that Lauren had made. Go ahead.
Right. Lauren was talking about the woman she was helping in her with the hospital, her frequent flyer, we call them hospital mm-hmm. visits, especially emergency room visits. And what she was talking about made me think and want to remind people that, you know, folks get health care. They may not get it regularly. They may not get the right kind in the right place, but they get health care, uninsured folks, and that's called uncompensated care. And we all pay for uncompensated care. Part of your sales tax goes to help pay for uncompensated care, and that's what counties like Rio Arriba end up using to try and reimburse the hospitals. And so through expansion, that there will no longer be that uncompensated care, or a lot less of it, let's put it that way. We've got to get people to enroll to do that. And so Lauren made a very important point there that these services are being paid for now. They're just not being paid for efficiently, and people are not getting well from them.
We got an email comment. How does Molina fit in all of this? This is a comment from Carolyn and Harold. Do they administer all new plans or some of them or none? Also, is there a plan administered by UNM Hospital? And they write they don't understand how someone ends up in a plan versus Molina. What are the differences between them? Is this a question that we can talk about? Is there an answer? There's some shaking of heads and shrugging of shoulders. Julie.
Okay. Molina Health Plan is one of our four managed care plans right now that is part of our Salud managed care program for physical health needs. So it's mostly serving women and children and some disabled persons. Molina is one of four choices that a person can make if they are currently in Medicaid. Molina also offers a plan through our state coverage insurance program, SCI. And don't know yet who our plans will be under the program that Secretary Squire was alluding to, our Centennial Care program, which goes into effect on January 1st, 2014. We are still in the process of procuring those new contractors.
Is Centennial Care related to the Medicaid expansion? It's very confusing.
Yes. Well, everything about Medicaid is very confusing. So all your listeners out there should know that they're not alone when they're confused. But it does sort of tangentially have something to do with Centennial Care, in that Centennial Care is based, the whole basis of Centennial Care is to get people the right care and in the right settings at the right time.
Which kind is, of like what Lauren was saying.
Right. It's not happening now. And like Lauren was saying, people go to the emergency room. You know what? That is really not a good place to get primary care.
Or when they're so severely ill because they did not get the primary care to begin with.
Right. So Centennial Care, what it's going to do for the current population and the population that comes on is it's kind of a wraparound service to make sure that whether you're the primary care, whether you're the specialty doctor, whether you're the pharmacist, behavioral health services, there is a care coordinator that talks to all of those people to make sure that the patient themselves are getting the right treatment and that there is some outcome of success.
But how is that different than like Molina as a medical care coordinator? You know, like aren't there already managed care organizations that are doing that?
We believe, yes, we have managed care organizations and they do a good job now. But what we're doing is putting a much stronger emphasis on care coordination. And if you read the RFP and the contract that goes with it, which is posted on the HSD website, you will see that care coordination is required. And there's certain kinds of activities of care coordination and different levels of intensity of care coordination that are required depending on the needs of the member. So there's more emphasis on that and more requirements to be actively care coordinating and helping people get the care they need where it will do them the most good.
Lauren.
Yeah, I can't really answer a question specifically about Molina. The problem from my perspective isn't any particular managed care organization. It's the lack of a system in healthcare in general, and this isn't specific to New Mexico. It's the United States at large. But one of the things that HSD is doing right now that I really want to compliment you guys on, and I think every county in New Mexico wants to compliment you on, is for years we had a program that was called the Sole Community Provider Program, where counties put up money, which was then matched with Medicaid dollars, to pay hospitals for uncompensated care. And we were never really sure what that money was spent on. It sort of went into the black hole of the hospital system, and counties had very little control or ability to try and improve the system and the kind of upfront primary care that people need to get healthy. And right now, HSD is working feverishly to change that. They've changed the acronyms. I'm not going to bore everyone with the acronyms.
Oh, please don't. Please don't.
But beyond the acronyms, they're in the process of changing the rules so that counties are able to participate in the planning process with hospitals, and a significant chunk of that money does not go to uncompensated care, and the amount going to uncompensated care will decrease over a 5-year period, but it's being put into something that I don't even know what the acronym stands for, DSRIP projects, which mean system reform projects.
Right.
And it enables us to look at how do we create care where we hold individual providers responsible for creating health outcomes in their patients. So right now, the way insurance charges, it's based on like 15-minute increments of time. We spent 15 minutes, pay us. This allows us the ability to say, well, we're going to pay you for producing a health outcome. So we're going to pay you for producing a baby that is born 5 pounds, 8 ounces or greater, which is a healthy birth weight. We're going to pay you for increasing a child's grade point level for 1 point, 1 percentage point. So we're going to pay you for specific things that we know mean that person is leading a better life. And that is the single biggest change that anyone could make to improve our healthcare system.
Let's take another call. Amanda in Rio Riba, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering about the 170,000 people and wondering mostly, aren't there more than 170,000 qualifying people in the state of New Mexico?
That is also what I've heard, and that the 170 number is people who are expected to apply to be taken into the system. Secretary Squire, you're nodding.
Absolutely. Those are estimates. There's no possible way that we can know for sure how many people would qualify. So we've done some, you know, we have those tricky number people that can do this kind of thing, and they've looked into it, and they've made an estimate that it should be about 170 people. Is it a little less? Is it some more? We'll find out.
Well, but the caller's question was, there are numbers that suggest there are more people who will be eligible than the 170 that are expected to apply for the benefits.
It's possible. It's possible.
And so what happens to so will there be a capacity for more people?
They will be able to get the services. Capacity is a different issue, and we talked about access in New Mexico already, so I don't want to make promises. But what I will say is that those people, over 170,000, will be eligible. They can apply, and if they qualify, they will be eligible to get services just like the first 170,000.
Mm-hmm. Lauren.
One thing I want to draw attention to is that there's a difference between healthcare financing and healthcare. And so even if not all the people who need healthcare financing get onto financing, it doesn't mean they can't get health care. If you are actually paying for services, you're not just paying for services for that individual. A lot of health care is subsidized by that uncompensated care has always been subsidized by paid people who have insurance or have Medicaid. And so we find ways to try and squeeze people in who don't have a financing source. If you have more people paying, even if 170,000 doesn't cover the whole pot of people, then there are going to be more services and more providers and more capacity. And that means there's more people we can find ways to get around the rules and sneak them in.
Well, so we do have an email comment from Paul who writes, what is the plan to increase the number of primary care physicians to serve the additional number of people who become eligible?
You know, Lauren said that, you know, there's a difference between healthcare and healthcare financing. And what Medicaid is a healthcare financing program. We pay for healthcare. We're a health plan. We are less involved in creating a healthcare workforce. That would be another topic for this show. But the number of things that we've been thinking about is changing the way healthcare is delivered and the way it's organized in a clinic or in an office so that the primary care physician is seeing the people who need to be seen by a doctor, whereas we have mid-level practitioners who do a great job in checkups and acute kind of colds and flus and things like that. And so one of the ideas is to help improve access to care is having access to more mid-level practitioners and using them as well as our docs.
Lauren, can you briefly describe your facility? Because I think, at least in my experience, it was a good example of exactly what Julie was just describing.
Well, we've created what we call the Rio Arriba Health Commons, which I'm very proud of because when I was first hired, our county didn't even have buildings, let alone a health commons. And what this is we have three providers that are located there. It's a one-stop shop. The County Health and Human Services Department is there. The Española Public Health Office, which is run by the Department of Health, is there. And El Centro Family Care, I believe it is. I always call them by their acronym, sorry, which is our largest primary care provider and an excellent provider is also located there. And we have mushed everybody up. We haven't put one agency, one wing. So we have our maternal child health wing, and then we have our medical wing, and we have our behavioral health wing. And aside from the fact that it's a stunning facility and we have a wonderful nutrition education classroom and telecommunication abilities, what this does is it causes us to talk to one another and to actually work together. So it's so much easier for me if my staff has a patient that they need to get into primary care, it's so much easier to walk across the hallway than it is to get on the phone and try and track the person down. It also causes us to write grants together and to weave together our services in a much more sensible manner.
I want to take a few more calls. Let's go to Colleen in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I just there's a couple things. I was just wondering what the state is doing to decrease the bureaucracy because that could lead to decreasing the cost of overall health care, all the middle people. And I was wondering, you know, maybe if there's some way to make it so that people could apply online instead of in person, or if there could be stations, like maybe electronic stations or some kind of coordinator at emergency rooms so that when people come to the emergency room for their primary health care, they can actually apply if they qualify. So that's all.
Okay, Julie. So,
hi, Colleen. Those are very good ideas. First of all, I would like to say we are a $4 billion health plan right now. That's without the expanded population, Medicaid population. And we spend about 2% of that $4 billion. The $4 billion is all for program and services, but and 2% of $4 billion is what we spend on administration. So we are lean, and we work as efficiently as we possibly can. I don't think we can get much more savings out of reducing the bureaucracy. But it's an idea. It's a legitimate idea. As far as making it easier to apply and station coordinators in emergency rooms and doing applications online, that's all coming. That will all be part of our new eligibility system that's going to be implemented, and there are certain requirements under the ACA for ease of access to and ease of applying for Medicaid.
Let's take another call. John in Albuquerque, you're on the air.
Yes, hopefully you can hear me. I'm in a public building.
You know what, John? We can barely hear you. Are you on a speakerphone?
No. Can you hear me okay now?
I can hear you a little bit better. Go ahead and give us your comments, and if you can keep them brief, we've got full lines.
Sure.
Wanted to say that I thought Lauren.
You know what, John? I'm going to have to go to another call because I just can't understand you. Our connection is just not so good. I'm really sorry. I hope you'll post your comments online at KUNM.org. Let's go to Mary Kay in Santa Fe. Good morning, Mary Kay. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was pleased to hear the secretary speak in support of school-based health centers, and I can't emphasize enough the role that they are playing in increasing access to care. And I encourage the state as a matter of public policy. It'll be really critical that the state sustains and expands school-based health centers as vital members of the health care delivery system. You know, I heard the governor say in her State of the State address, let's put our kids first this session, and this is an opportunity to do so. I thank both the secretary and Julie for their work.
Thanks for your call, Mary Kay. Let's go to Bob in Albuquerque. Good morning, Bob. You're on the air.
Good morning, Elaine. Thanks for a great show. I just wanted to push the idea and to let people know that we should take this and go further with it. It's real cumbersome and complicated. I can see that. But there's a much better system, and it's like us veterans get. I'm a combat veteran from Vietnam, and I get socialized health care out to VA hospital. I don't pay a penny or see a piece of paperwork. I just walk in for surgeries or whatever I need. And I think we could have a system like that for all the people in the country. Some people call it single payer, if we just keep pushing harder. So I think you just got to keep in mind, too, that there are better solutions out there that are much more simpler and comprehensive if we just keep fighting for them. And I appreciate your show today. Thank you.
Super. Thanks for your call, Bob. Let's go to one more call. Greg in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Greg Sandoval. I'm an architect here in Albuquerque. This is directed at Secretary Sprier. My question, the Affordable Care Act is a great step in providing increased access to health care for both children and adults. Yet, Secretary Sprier, you mentioned that the governor cares very much for children on Medicaid, but under Medicaid expansion, if federal funding does not continue, the governor will cut adults last enrolled in Medicaid. So I guess the issue I have is the reality is New Mexico is the second poorest state, and adults are the caregivers of children. So does the governor have a backup plan to help adults in case future federal funding on Medicaid is cut? Because we know her party, the Republican Party, in Congress never wanted the Affordable Care Act to begin with. So what is the governor's backup plan?
Well, I think you need to understand that the amount of, if the federal government doesn't pay, the amount of money that the general fund, the state taxpayers, would have to come up with is enormous. It's hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And the truth of the matter is the state doesn't have that money, and you don't really need to take my word for it. You can talk to the Senate, the Democratic senators and representatives that are up there now working on the budget, and they will tell you without that, there just isn't the money. You can't create that much money. So therein lies the problem. But she is pushing very much for the federal government to live up to their promise.
Well, and something that we haven't mentioned so far this morning is that the existing Medicaid program here in New Mexico, is it still kind of four federal dollars for every one New Mexico dollar in the system? That has kind of traditionally been sort of the proportion. The Medicaid expansion, of course, is paid for fully by the federal government for the first several years, and then a 10% contribution from the state is phased in by 2020. So there's the existing Medicaid program and how much New Mexico pays into that, and then there's the expansion and how much New Mexico would be responsible to pay into that. Lauren, you had a comment.
Yeah, I'd like to. My answer to that gentleman's question is the very best way to force the federal government to keep their promises is for communities all across America to rush forward and create facts on the ground. Because when you create facts on the ground, you change people's expectations and they demand continuation of the services. So I think that the governor is doing the right thing by taking this risk, and I want to help her put as many facts on the ground as I can. And I do have a question for Secretary Sprier from all my colleagues, my Health and Human Service County colleagues all across the state. The new program that you're creating, you're asking counties to present budgets to be matched by February 15th, but we have two problems there. The first is that you don't quite know what the matching rules are yet, and the second is that we don't know what the legislature is going to do, so we don't really know what our local budgets are, so we don't know how much we could match. So my question for you from my colleagues is, could we please put off that deadline to April 15th so that we can do something really sensible? And I also just want to compliment you on two of your staff, Larry Hayek and Anna Bransford, who have done an amazing job in helping counties to partner with you to reform the system.
Yes or no, maybe, on that deadline, and then we can follow up with details?
Maybe.
Maybe. We've got a maybe from Secretary Sprier on an extension of a deadline for counties in New Mexico. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us for this conversation about the expansion of Medicaid here in New Mexico. Julie Weinberg is the state Medicaid director. Lauren Reichelt is the director of the Rio Arriba County Health and Human Services Department. And Sydney Sprier is the secretary of the New Mexico Department of Human Services. You can hear this program, if you missed part of it, online at KUNM.org just a little bit after we get off the air. And thanks so much for joining us. Next week, we're going to talk about investigative grand juries that are used in police officer-involved shootings. You'll want to stay tuned for that next Thursday morning at 8 here on KUNM.